Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sean Parnell, a former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger who served in the 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain. He received 2 Bronze Stars and the Purple Heart and is the author, with John Bruning, of Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Parnell.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And clearly we're at a time now where you feel like, I think it's been going on for some time, that the Americans or NATO and the Afghans have had a very star-crossed relationship, shall we say. But now it's reached a sort of untenable point, it seems, where the American soldiers who are making the sacrifice there, and the American taxpayer, of course, is making sacrifice, are wondering what they're getting for what they put in. And on the other hand, you get the impression that the Afghans more and more are starting to see the Americans and NATO not so much as liberators, but as occupiers who've overstayed their welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable to conclude that right now. I do think that it's moving in that direction. If we aren't there already.
When you first went in, it seems like in the first engagement that you're expecting a kind of ragtag bunch of irregulars, but you got a real wake-up call, right?
Yeah, so tell
us about that.
Well, I mean, when we went to Afghanistan, the eyes of the nation, the American political apparatus and the military brass was wholeheartedly focused on Iraq and the growing insurgency there. What are we going to do about Iraq? And so we did the best we could training in garrison to prepare for an eventual combat deployment to Afghanistan, but we didn't know. We couldn't even glean intelligence from our own military brass on what it would actually be like because nobody cared. So when we got there, we thought, you know, let's just say we weren't facing farmers with pitchforks. These guys were seasoned and hardened light infantry that had been fighting literally for the better part of 30 years.
Wow. It feels like it was always an orphan project. Did you ever feel like that you guys were getting shortchanged and the real focus was on Iraq?
So get this. When we got to Afghanistan, we were bolting our own armor on our Humvees. We had pickup truck Humvees that the Army didn't even use anymore. We had the only up armored Humvee that we had at the time was used in Bosnia.
Oh, wow.
So that was what we had to work with initially. I mean, it got better. It got better when people realized that Afghanistan, I think, in 2006 was really spiraling out of control. And that's when I think people really started to take notice. It got better. But that's what we were dealing with initially.
But one of the things that's so ironic about it is that the initial takedown of the Taliban was done with only about 800 soldiers, or something unbelievable.
Yeah.
Done very effectively. And my understanding is that the Afghan people really thought the Americans were the liberators and that they thought, wow, you know, you're the guys that put somebody on the moon. You're going to fix this place and everything's going to be hunky-dory. And it didn't happen.
No, yeah. And I think you're talking about the difference in strategy. And I've been very critical of the strategy that's being implemented in Afghanistan right now. But what we're talking about back in 2001, 2002, 2003, we had a counter-terror strategy where we were relying heavily on special operations units to do the fighting in Afghanistan, supported with air, and it was pretty effective. I mean, we took down the Taliban in just a short few months, and Afghanistan seemed like it was moving in the right direction. And then all of a sudden, there was this sudden shift around 2003 to this nation-building counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan that's just not going to work.
And when did you come into Afghanistan?
2006, January 2006.
So this strategy was already 3 years on. And I remember talking to David Kilcullen, who's one of the guys that was behind the surge, Petraeus's advisor, and he came up with this notion of the armed social worker.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like you guys were doing a lot of social work.
No. So the idea of therapeutic social workers out of the window when people are shooting at you, you know, you realize that you're not a social worker when people are shooting at you. But we didn't do a whole lot of that. I mean, the idea of counterinsurgency operations was really in its infancy when we were there. This was our idea of counterinsurgency. We were focused on going out and finding the enemy and rooting them out in this lawless, mountainous border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But that was only one part of our mission. We accomplished the counterinsurgency, but we accomplished that part of the mission by making every mission simultaneously a humanitarian one as well. We packed, along with our ammunition, we packed coloring books for kids, food, water, you know, clothes for the locals. And every patrol that we went on was simultaneously a humanitarian patrol, and it worked extraordinarily well. I mean, we wreaked devastating effects on our enemy there, and we never, ever once killed one civilian, ever, the entire time there.
But you were also, and when you were there, you know, you were the unit, your platoon took 80% casualties, the highest since Gettysburg, right there on the Afghan-Pakistan border. In a way, you were right there in the middle of all of the problems that the U.S. have had since 2001.
Mm-hmm.
The duplicity of the Pakistanis and the corruption of the leadership. Let's start with the duplicity of the Pakistanis. That's something, you're looking at Pakistan every day, right?
Yep, every single day. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the bad guys are coming from, right?
Yeah.
And the guys that you occasionally liaison with, the Pakistani guards, or the Frontier Corps, I guess mm-hmm. they're called, you know, you liaise with them, but you know they're working for the other guys, right?
Yeah. So the Frontier Corps, here's some context of the Frontier Corps. When the Brits were occupying Pakistan, they had a model called the Northwest Frontier Corps, where they had one British officer with several active duty pack mill soldiers on the border, and they would man border checkpoints. So when the Brits left and Pakistan took over their own country, they kept that same model and called it the Frontier Corps on the border. And they had one active duty pack mill officer with several ragtag militia from local villages around the area that didn't recognize the border at all. So that right there is the problem with the border, is the fact that the people that are manning the Frontier Corps and these border checkpoints, they don't recognize the Durand Line, which is basically a pencil scratch on a map to the locals.
But I understand from your book again, Sean Parnell, Outlaw Platoon: Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan, that the pack mill, as you call them, were much, much closer to both the insurgents and to the Haqqani network.
Yes. Yeah. So we give Pakistan, I think, roughly $6 billion a year in humanitarian and military assistance. And what we saw when we were there is that they were treating our enemy in their hospitals, giving their antibiotics to heal, and then sending them back on the battlefield. And then there were some instances where our enemy was using pack mill checkpoints to fire at us from those checkpoints, effectively using the pack mill as human shield, knowing that we couldn't shoot back at them without causing an international incident. And then the pack mill Frontier Corps came to attack us directly on several occasions, and it was never reported on the news back here even once. And that's one of the major themes, sort of ancillary themes that I talk about in Outlaw Platoon, is that we have this idea in this country that the Pakistan is our erstwhile ally, both strategically and on the ground, and that is just not the case.
So what do you think their end game is? Because this incident that just took place with the U.S. soldier massacred their civilians, 9 kids sleeping in their beds, that's clearly having a detrimental effect, and a lot of analysts say it's going to accelerate the withdrawal.
Yep.
What do you see as the Pakistan end game?
Well, I think this is there's a real complex geopolitical situation surrounding Pakistan, and I think they benefit. The central government of Pakistan benefits greatly from a weak Afghanistan, and I think their conflict and sworn conflict with India is the reason why they benefit. And I think what they want at a strategic level is to use Afghanistan as a buffer should there be a conflict with India. I think that's reason number one for the keeping Afghanistan unstable. And it's very complicated for us too, because Pakistan is a nuclear power. And our worst fear is that somehow, like a tactical nuclear weapon, will find its way into the hands of a terrorist. And I think that's
right. Well, it's not out of the question, given that Pakistan is the fastest growing nuclear arsenal on the planet.
Yep.
They've just surpassed the French in the numbers of warheads they have, and they're apparently equal now to the Brits, at least as far as we know. They claim to have a very professional command and control over their nuclear weapons. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what did we learn from the takedown of Osama bin Laden right next to their military academy? It's one of three possibilities. One, that the ISI and the top military knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or two, somebody down the chain of command knew about it, lower down in the ranks of ISI, etc. Or three, none of the above knew about it. Now, number three is almost too ridiculous to even contemplate. So if you take number two, then you don't have any confidence that they have real good command and control. And that seems to be their excuse, that maybe some people down the chain knew about it, but not us guys at the top. Mm-hmm. What's your take on it?
First of all, I'm really impressed with how well informed you are in your use of the military lingo. I'm impressed. But to your point, I think if I were a betting man, which I'm not, but if I was, I would put money on mid-level Packy ISI knowing exactly where he was and not acting on it. I mean, I'd put money on it that they knew.
So how does the rank and file then feel, given that you guys are putting in life on the line and you had the highest casualties, your platoon, 80%, the highest since Gettysburg, how do you keep your morale up when you know the guys, as you can see across the way there, are shooting you in the back, so as to speak, and you know that your partners are, well, let's talk about your partners. We talked about Pakistan's duplicity. Walk us through some of your experiences in terms of Afghanistan's corruption and, we're doing nation building with Karzai, and nobody's ever suggested that this guy was Afghanistan's Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. No. There's corruption at literally every level of their government. So this idea that we can somehow prop up a Jeffersonian democracy in Afghanistan is just ludicrous to me. Our experience with the Afghan National Army initially was not good. They got better because we had, as time wore on, we embedded U.S. Marines with them to train them, so they got better. But most of the time, we were the ones fighting and bleeding for their country while the Afghan National Army played soccer or smoked hash. And it's, to your point and question about morale, our morale stayed up because of how we relied on one another and our love for one another. We focused on what mattered most to us, and that was faith in each other. And I made sure, like when I wrote the book, to capture the human element of war, which is so often lost. I think all the best soldiers are humanists. And what's funny is that like people scoff, especially on the left, at the idea of a humanistic sort of soldier. But
right. Well,
I think
it sounds like an oxymoron.
It does. People laugh at it. But I think the best soldiers are humanists. And what I wanted to do when I wrote this book was show the world, and specifically American society, how wonderfully diverse my platoon was and how that was their greatest strength, was their diversity.
But on the other hand, the guys that are coming at you from day one, from your first encounter, they're obviously highly motivated. I mean, I don't know whether you saw the documentary Restrepo.
I did. Mm-hmm. That was one of the units that I trained. They came right after us.
And that was in the same Corrigan Valley, right?
We were south. The Brumell Valley was south, but that unit came right after us.
Right. But in that particular firebase that they had, they were coming at, about an 80-degree angle or something, attacking at an 80-degree angle. It's unheard of.
I mean,
since, maybe Gallipoli or something.
No. This happens in Afghanistan. This is a regular occurrence. On June 10th, 2006, we were almost overrun by an enemy that outnumbered us 5-1. They were charging up unbelievable angles and mountains to get to us. They were running through sheets of artillery that we were calling on. They were actually trying to get closer to us so that we couldn't fire artillery at them anymore. And, I was about to give the command fixed bayonets, and I realized that we don't carry bayonets anymore. So what do you do? But these fighters, our enemy in Afghanistan, has absolutely no fear, and they are highly motivated.
And what did you guys, first of all, it's got to be scary as hell.
It is.
And two, what did you finally conclude about their motivation? They're fighting for their land?
Yeah, I don't know. I think most of the fighters that we were fighting weren't even from Afghanistan.
They weren't. They were the
foreign fighters. And I mean,
these are the guys that are indoctrinated on the other side and come over.
Yeah.
You weren't actually fighting Afghans then?
For the most part, no. For the most part, no. I mean, the enemy that we were facing in our area of operations was not a monolithic force at all. I mean, we saw Haqqani Network, we saw Taliban, and we saw Al-Qaeda foreign fighters, all of which we faced in one way, shape, or form. And what we saw as the deployment wore on was the Haqqani Network formed this loose partnership with the Taliban because their goals are different. They don't really like each other, but they joined forces to fight us. And what we saw after they joined forces was that they would coalesce around these tough Al-Qaeda foreign fighters who had been fighting jihad all around the globe all their lives, who then trained them as their sort of rudimentary command and control And that's when things got really difficult for us.
And so given the recent events that I think combined with the Quran burning and this recent massacre, you can tell that even the Republican opponents of President Obama are now saying we should get out.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American people in general are probably pretty tired of this whole thing.
I think they are too.
So what's your sense of how the chips are going to fall here? We got till 2014, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of an Afghan army is going to be standing up in 2014?
Well, I don't think the Afghan army is ready. I think that they've got courageous fighters and infantrymen, boots on the ground soldiers that are willing to fight and die for their country, which is great. But in order to have an army, you have to be able to move them, feed them, give them water, supply them, and pay them. And the Afghan government is not capable of that. And until you meet those criteria that I just mentioned, you don't have an army, and they don't have one. We still pay them.
Right.
So,
and by the way, the Wall Street Journal reported that in 2011, $5 billion in cash went out of Kabul airport to the Gulf. So you get the feeling that the elite have been living off this war, profiting from it, and they've already got one foot out of the country already, and mm-hmm. their money's parked in Dubai.
Yeah, I think that. So, to your question of where do we go from here,
right.
I think that, first of all, the Quran burnings, terrible mistake. And I think that this massacre of these civilians at the hand of this rogue soldier was the worst thing that could have happened in the wake of these Quran burnings. And I understand people's anger and frustration and the fact that they're horrified at the loss of life. But I think we really should resist running for the door just yet. I think now we have a unique opportunity to take a look at our strategy and change directions. But here's the most important point. American interests decide in Afghanistan. Thousands of civilian Afghans will die if we pull out.
Uh-huh.
And
you mean in a renewed civil war?
In a renewed civil war, and those Afghans that were those thousands of Afghans that have supported us in our time there will die.
But is there anything that we can do? I mean, to prevent that. I mean, what is a workable strategy? Because I understand that there's Biden's been fighting against counterinsurgency, mm-hmm. as you have suggested. It was a forced strategy starting in 2003, right?
Yep.
He's been against it and tried to argue in favor of counterterrorism.
Yes.
And Petraeus pretty much won that argument, but now he's at the CIA, so I guess there's a vacuum there. What's the alternative strategy then? How could you have a workable counterterrorism strategy with a few boots on the ground?
Well, I think, we accomplished great things with the counterterrorist strategy in 2001 through 2003. I think we need to go back to that model, first of all. But I also think that we need to start putting more pressure on Hamid Karzai to try to unify Afghans under a common banner. And Massoud was actually able to do that until he was killed just prior to 9/11. People in Afghanistan, all around the country, regardless of province, they still carry pictures of the guy around in their wallet. So he was able to do it. And
right.
I think we need to see and take a look at how he was able to affect the hearts and minds of so many Afghans. And I think we need to try to put more pressure on Karzai to do that, to get there.
But we've been doing that forever, putting pressure on him. And I mean, my understanding is that the secret talks that are going on now in Dubai, the Afghans aren't even in these talks. It's largely the Taliban, and very opaque, not much is known about it, but the U.S. is supposedly meeting secretly with the Taliban. I imagine it would be the Pakistanis must be brokering it. There's no way in the world they're not going to, be a part of this. So it's difficult to understand what the negotiations. Do you think that there would ever be a way that the Taliban, and particularly the guys that you're fighting, which are even the more extreme guys, right, the Al-Qaeda and the Haqqani, they don't know how to do anything else, right? So if you're going to have with a weak government there, what would be a counter-terrorism strategy to contain them so that we don't go back to what we had before 9/11?
Well, I think just our presence there with regards to it. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. I think just our presence there will deter these foreign fighters enough so that we don't go back to a pre-9/11 era in Afghanistan. But if we pulled out of Afghanistan tomorrow, and I just told you that I think a lot of thousands of Afghans will die if that happens. But that aside, if we pull out of Afghanistan tomorrow, it will fall right back to where it was in 2 months prior to us being there September 11th. I mean, I think you'd see the Akhani network and Haig and Hekmati, our soldiers, foot soldiers, take control of the border. And I think you'd see the Taliban back in central Afghanistan. And
would there be any way to revive the Northern Alliance so that they wouldn't take over the entire country?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean by, I think, that comment is nested under what Hamid Karzai needs to do. And I think that he needs to sort of reinvigorate the Northern Alliance to start taking some risks, you know. And I think that's it. I mean, the path to liberty is fraught with peril. And I think that Hamid Karzai, the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, you know, in conjunction with the Northern Alliance, needs to start taking some risks, you know.
Well, but last time around, they got support from Russia or the mm-hmm. Soviet Union and Iran. And we know that the Pashtuns and the Taliban get support from Pakistan. So then you get into the broader issue of the geopolitics of the neighborhood, right?
Yep.
And that would mean that the U.S. would have to work. We're having trouble working with the Russians, although that's where the supplies have been coming through now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even talking to the Iranians.
Yeah, and most of the weapons when we were there at the tail end of our deployment, every weapon that we would find on the battlefield were fresh off of the Iranian factory line, RPG-9, armor-piercing RPG-9s, brand-new PKMs, RPKs, and Kalashnikov AK-47 assault rifles, all with Iranian serial numbers. Nobody was talking about that here back in the States in 2006.
Wow.
And so I think we're looking at an enemy force that's being fully funded by Iran.
Well, I think we've run out of time here. And there's so much more to discuss in your book, Outlaw Platoon, Sean Parnell. But I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, this was a great conversation. Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sean Parnell. He's a former U.S. Army Airborne Ranger who served in the 10th Mountain Division for 6 years, retiring as a captain. He received 2 Bronze Stars and a Purple Heart and is the author, with John Bruning, of Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the youngest ever U.S. congressman, in this case, congresswoman.
When the president talks to God, do they drink near beer and go play golf while they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade when the president talks to God. When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not, that voice is just inside his head?